The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 1013. It's the 9th of March, 2018. On the podcast today, I have George Roach, CEO of Premier African Minerals, and George discusses progress at their projects and dispels some social media rumours. Plus, I also have on Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talking about Trump's trade tariffs and the trade war that could happen, the exemptions and why they're doing it. Also covers the stocks Stock Spirits Group, STCK, Cortex, which is QTC, and Quixent, which is QXT. Plus, I also have market analyst with SpreadX, Connor Campbell, talking about companies releasing updates next week, including Fevertree. I think they're very overvalued. Well, who knows? It's momentum. And I discuss that. Morrison's, MRW, and JD Weatherspoon, JDW. In fact, just to cover myself, I don't think they're overvalued. I think they're highly valued. and also JD Weatherspoon, JDW. I do compare the valuations there of those three as well. Plus, as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is George Roach, CEO of Premier African Minerals. That's PREM ticker. George, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you very much indeed, and great to be chatting to you.
Yeah, well, it's nice to get an email, quite short notice, saying you want to come to the podcast and have a chat, which is always good. Always good to update shareholders. Before we get into the chat, George, for people not aware of Premier African Minerals, can you explain or summarise what the business is all about, please?
Sure. The business is about bringing exciting exploration, mineral exploration projects forward, adding value to them, bringing some of them to a point of mining, particularly projects like our Zulu Lithium project in Zimbabwe and our RHA Tungsten project.
Excellent stuff. And just explain where you are as far as Zulu and RHA, if you could.
Okay, well, let's talk about Zulu first. Zulu is an advanced stage exploration play in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe has recently confirmed that the historic indigenization requirements no longer apply and don't apply to any of the projects that PREM currently is busy with in Zimbabwe. The next stage for Zulu Lithium is to progress this with some additional drilling test work and moving directly into a feasibility study that has got a timeline of approximately 10 to 12 months to completion. In terms of the financing and funding of that, Premier owns 100% of the Zulu deposit, and we are in some very serious negotiations that are now advanced with prospective parties who are looking to invest into the project on the basis of acquiring takeoff rights and some equity directly in the project. And we're hoping to have some interesting and exciting announcements in regard to that in the near future. So that's as far as Zulu is concerned. I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah.
Moving on to the RHA project. RHA is still owned 51 by the Indigenization Economic Empowerment Fund. Now, policy in Zimbabwe, as I said, has already changed. It's been stated publicly and privately that indigenization doesn't apply. We already have an agreement from the Indigenization Economic Empowerment Fund that on the basis of PREM capitalizing its loan account in RHA, which is just over $20 million, that we would receive additional shares in the local Zimbabwean company to the extent that we would hold not less than 90% of the project. Now, It's a bureaucratic process, to be quite frank, in terms of just getting this done, signed, and enacted. And it's pretty frustrating from my perspective. I think it's pretty frustrating from our shareholders' perspective as well, and definitely from our staff's perspective. But the willingness, the acceptance, the realization of the problems that the delay is causing is understood by everybody. And I'm quite confident that from the Zimbabwean perspective, they're as anxious to get this done as I am. Once that is done, in taking RHA forward, if you recall, RHA was very close to production late last year. At the time that we put it on hold so that this ownership issue could be resolved, our mine management late in December had asked for additional funding, and I'd been saying for some time I wasn't prepared to put more money in until the ownership issues were resolved. Well, when they resolved, we'll get back to RHA. I believe that in going back to RHA, it would be sensible at this time to do a further little bit of exploration work on the open pit, which is where we originally started mining, and to determine definitively whether or not that pit can and should be brought back into production. If it can, that would be great and good news for RHA, because it would then be producing from underground and from the open pit. In terms of financing to get that done, we are again in some late stage negotiations with some very serious parties keen on looking at tungsten, largely because of the improving fundamentals that seem to be coming through in regard to tungsten at the moment. The price has been strong on wolframite. It's around about $320+ a metric ton unit. There are indications that there may be short supply coming. There are indications that others who are entering or planning on entering into mining of wolframite may not achieve their objectives of getting into production as quickly as possible. And it is, the sentiment seems to be changing and seems to be getting pretty positive. So that is supportive of what we're intending to do as far as RHA is concerned.
Marvellous. Okay, well, George, I got the email and straight away, I checked your RNS sort of feed to see if there'd been news out, because you wanted to come on the podcast. But I didn't see any. Thought, have I missed something here? So why are you coming on the podcast, George? What do you want to express here?
Well, I think that what really drove it today is that there's been a whole lot of social media comments that have been sent to me, some in relation to Circum, and some that seem to suggest that Prem is busy doing a placement at the moment. Well, I can't be doing a placement and having a conversation with you. Yeah. So we can deal with that one immediately. I'm not doing a placement at the moment. It's a Friday afternoon, and I'm not going to do a placement today. In terms of Circum, there have been a number of comments on social media that seem to emanate from one of the Circum directors at PDAC. And basically what has been reported to me, and some of this I'm going to confirm, some of it I can't, is that Circum does plan on completing an IPO in the near future. Now, the date for completion of that IPO, I understand, is still subject to a final sign-off with a broker of choice. And I don't know that decision has been made yet, although if there's a Circum director listening, hopefully they'll correct me and tell me if it has. The intention, as I understand, is to look to raise up to $300 million. That is the number that has been reported in social media as well. And that would complement the debt package that Circum confidently expects to be able to match at the time to allow them to bring that project into production, construct and bring it into production on a optimized DFS model that is either completed or very close to being completed. Now, at the same time in social media, there was a comment made that the valuation of this project was now only $100 to $200 million. Well, I find that a bit difficult to accept that that can be an accurate quotation if you're busy raising $300 million in an IPO. So I think that that just kind of says that isn't quite correct.
Yeah.
Circum's NPV on its original DFS was $2.1 billion. I have no doubt that the capex associated with that should reduce, and I think they will reduce it in terms of an optimized DFS, which is likely to look at a slightly lower production quantum. But whilst I can't tell you what that NPV is going to be, I'm pretty sure it's not going to be $100 to $200 million. So I'm pretty sure that's a misquotation as well. The only other thing that is worth saying is that the same social media is indicating that in the event of an IPO, Prem would be in a locked up position and not able to access cash if it elected and chose to sell some or all of its Circum shares. And I can say definitively that at this stage, Premier is not in a locked up position at all. Okay. So hopefully some of this that is going on in the background in social media can be resolved and sorted out. And hopefully your platform can help me with that.
Well, we'll see. But, you know, it's you've dispelled lots of rumours there. And who knows why rumours start. But we suspect sometimes. But hopefully people will share this. And, you know, holders of Prem stock will share this. And the truth will out there. So, George, thanks for the appeal to come on. And hopefully that will solve the problem and resolve that issue there. And one final thing, George, as always, if someone's listening right now and not following the story, but you think they should do, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, let's start off with the fact that I think that as a result of these rumours, our share price has been marked down to a level that has got to be very attractive based on the fundamental value of the projects. Secondly, that we expect exciting news to come out of Zimbabwe in the form of confirmation of the equity change at RHA. And thirdly, that we are very close to final decisions in regard to the further development of Zulu.
Excellent stuff. George, thanks for coming on, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Indeed we will. Thank you very much indeed.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Ross Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Ross?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you? I'm a bit better than you. I think you sound a bit sniffly, dare I say.
Yeah, I seem to pick up my share and my wife's share of the cold from the kids all the time. She doesn't ever get anything, and I seem to pick it up all the time. And I think it doesn't help that I spend a lot of time in my own little studio room, and when I go out and mix with other people, maybe I'm not, you know, having a good immune system. I don't know.
Yeah, there you go. Obviously, spend so much time in your hermetically sealed office. So
yeah, that's it. Yeah,
which need to get out a bit more.
It's how I like it, though. talking about getting out a bit more, I see, you know, Kim Jong-un and Trump are going to get out a bit more, meet each other. But also, I think that's good news story overshadowed a little bit the tariffs, which you mentioned last week. And he has says he's going to do 25% on, I think, steel, was it, and 10% on aluminium. Is that right?
And it is, yeah, with the exceptions, it seems, of Canada and Mexico.
Yeah, and also, I've just seen on Twitter, I don't know how many countries have applied for it, but UK have applied for exemptions, the Brazil have applied for exemptions, and I'm thinking, well, if everyone applies for exemptions, it's no longer a tariff, is it?
No, but I can understand how the exemptions happen, because I think Trump's trying to get at one country in particular.
China,
which is China. Yeah, absolutely right, Justin. And if you look at the statistics, from the top of my head, the US trade deficit last year was $600 billion. China on its own was $375 billion of that. Now, China is not big as far as it comes to steel exports to the US. It's America's 11th biggest supplier externally, so it's not a big deal. And it's not in the top three in aluminium either.
Yeah.
But there are easy things to get at. There is Chinese overcapacity there. The reason that Canada and Mexico have bobbled up to the top of the list for exemptions, well, Canada is America's biggest export source, and Mexico is its second biggest. Yeah. So some common sense and self-interest is prevailing there, either because the president's realised or wise counsel within the Oval Office has got the message through. So I can understand that. The UK is a big trade partner for the US, but we actually run a pretty much a balanced trade with them. I think we have, the UK has a very slight surplus, but you know, literally a few billion bucks, nothing to get overexcited about in the grand Chinese scheme of things anyway. So I, as we discussed, it's really very hard to win a trade war, full stop. You know, we discussed Smoot-Hawley last week. It definitely made things worse in the 1930s, even if it didn't cause the Great Recession, the imposition of tariffs then by the USA, because that led to tit-for-tat reprisals. That's clearly what, again, wise heads in the Oval Office are looking to get around. I think Canada had threatened to start putting tariffs on American wine, intriguingly, just as a pointer of what could possibly happen. So hopefully this will calm things down. But nevertheless, it still could mean there could be a deterioration of trade relationships between America and China, because ultimately that's what the tariffs are there for, and that's what the president wants to see.
Yeah. And
wouldn't view it as a deterioration. He would view it as an improvement in U.S. trade with China, but I'm not sure the Chinese would see it that way.
Yeah, so I suppose you just can't come out and say, right, I'm going to slap on anti-Chinese tariff. You can't do that, can you?
I think that's tricky, I'm afraid to say. Yeah. I think that's going to cause all sorts of trouble, and I think he knows that he can't spell it out quite so clearly, but using tariffs on everybody is obviously therefore using a very blunt instrument. But it's a step in the right direction that some exemptions have been put in there, but I'm sure the Chinese are going to quickly realise that they're one of the very few countries that isn't going to get the exemption, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So what I mean, on your opinion, what do you say on the EU? Because I know he's been, he's actually tweeted about the EU as well, and he's tweeted about China. How do you think it's going to go down for the EU? So do you think it's going to be EU and China left out of this or not?
That's perfectly possible. He's not a big fan of the EU, and I can understand why, because if you're looking at it strategically on a long-term view, the EU is the world's biggest economic bloc. It's actually bigger than America in aggregate, and that makes it a major competitor and a major rival to America's political, financial, and economic hegemony. So I can understand why the EU would probably be removed from, would not be given any exemptions. I mean, talking to US friends, they still view the European Union as the world's biggest retirement home. They've nothing but contempt for it. They view it as a welfare-riddled area where people just sort of loaf about and don't do very much. But nevertheless, in aggregate, it is still a huge economic power. I think that's got slightly baffled as to how they've managed it. I think it, you know, weight of people is clearly a part of it. Yeah. They're not big fans, but they nevertheless accept if it ever gets its act together, you know, if it ever gets to be hyper efficient, it really could make a proper nuisance of itself on the world stage from an American perspective. So I think the EU will be out on the cold in terms of the exemption list. Yes, very definitely.
Marvellous, okay. All right, let's move on to stocks. Russ, what are you looking
at? Yes, three stocks. So all ones that we've looked at before. So these are all updates. Stock Spirits, Quartix, and Quixent. So this is obviously a good Scrabble score week as well.
Yes, Stock Spirits. What's the ticker there?
STCK.
STCK, cool. What's happening there?
It's a small cap, about 500 odd million cap. And remember, this company makes spirits and distributes brandy, vodkas, fruit liqueurs across Eastern Europe. It's Polish by origin, but it's got businesses in the Czech Republic, Croatia, Bosnia, da, da, da. And it's had full year figures out. The January trading statement was okay. Remember, the stocks had a wild ride. 2016 was a difficult year for it. Price war broke out in its home market of Poland. The company's had to adapt to that. Mm-hmm. And encouraging signs, I think you would say, from the full year figures. Revenues were up 5%. Volumes were up 6.5%. Ugly headline figures, earnings per share of €0.06 against 14 a year ago. A lot of that was down to an impairment on the Italian business and Polish tax changes. The underlying profits were actually up 14%, so that doesn't look too bad. Yeah. And the dividend per share was nudged up to €0.081. So that all seems okay. They did, most importantly, they talk about the Polish market stabilizing. They actually squeezed out a small increase in revenues there. They've had to realign massively on price. There's a new CFO coming, as the other ones retired in November, so let's see what they've got to say. And I think so that's all kind of steady as she goes, been through a torrid period, coming out the other side. It's now interesting to, I think the question marks are now obviously, where do we go from here? The company made a small acquisition in Irish whiskey, Quintessential, last year. And the company does talk about more investment this year in digital marketing, in brand, to premiumize the brands, to, quote, improve our relationship with millennials, which is interesting and we'll come back to, and also, quote, strategic M&A. So I think in that respect, there's clearly money, there's clearly expenses going in. That's probably going to restrain earnings per share growth a little bit. for the long-term potential benefit of the business. So it's a matter of whether you want your jam now, or vodka now in this case, or whether you're prepared to, you know, put the lid on the bottle and wait for a couple of years to see what happens. 8% earnings growth this year, 4% next year. Okay, fine, perfectly solid, but you're paying 18 times for that with a 3% yield. It's cheaper than the major European vintners and distillers like Diageo, Pernod Ricard, Rémy Cointreau, but then it probably deserves to be because its brands aren't as strong, quite frankly, and its margins aren't as high. Newmeast have got a 330p price target against the current 262. I don't think it's screamingly expensive. I don't think it's screamingly cheap. I think the question mark that we've got is, can they premiumise? How much is it going to cost them? And in terms of relationship with millennials, do we really want to be premiumising? Because the poor beggars haven't got any money. Yeah. You know, they're not going to be wanting to pay 20 quid for a glass of brandy or a glass of vodka when they can buy four bottles of the stuff from Tesco for the same price. So I think it's a difficult balancing act for a lot of these brand companies, and we're seeing it in other, you know, whether it's Unilever or whoever. You can only probably push your brand so far, and certainly your future buyers, the millennials, you've got to start thinking about what they're going to want. And we can see from the takeaway companies, they're not eating out, they're eating in. They're not drinking out, they're drinking in. So you're going to need to be careful in terms of how you address them in terms of price, as well as how you address them in terms of marketing and reach and social media. So it's a difficult balancing act. I think Stock Spirits, if you've got it, is fine. You're just sort of in the short term struggling for a catalyst that's going to merely really make the share price want to get going again, I think.
Yeah, these spirits companies, I mean, they are quite highly valued. I mean, you know, profit before tax is 27 million and their valuation is like 500 million. Okay, you know, I mean, it's nothing to be just chatting about Fever Tree. That's, I mean, a ridiculous valuation there. I can understand this.
I guess you can always say that Poles are always going to drink vodka, aren't they? Or the Brits or whoever. You know, you can generally see there's pretty consistent demand there. Then the multiple will really depend upon the brands you've got, the pricing power that you've got. But there are some big questions going forwards for all of these companies. How do you connect with the next generation of drinkers? Yeah. And if indeed they are drinkers at all, because, you know, I know we hear a lot about binge drinking in the UK, but equally I know a lot of, you know, my cousins and nieces, nephews, a lot of their friends just don't drink at all, partly because they haven't got the cash. Yeah. And partly because they don't like what they see sometimes on a street on a Friday and Saturday night and think, actually, I don't want to get involved with any of that. Thank you very much indeed. Yeah. So there's some interesting challenges there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, but you know, I was just saying, you know, Fever Tree there's none. I mean, I suppose that Fever Tree's profit is probably twice what Stock Spirits are, but their valuation is $3 billion. Sorry, go on, Russ.
So the next one is Quartix, QTX on AIM, Cambridge-based company, 170 million market cap. Remember, it's a provider of telematics and tracking systems for fleet operators of trucks and vehicles and vans, and also for insurance companies. Now, it's looking to sort of de-emphasize the insurance, where the deals are very big, but the margins can be pretty skinny, and move more towards the fleet side. And we've had some full-year figures that show that this trend, you know, the strategy is ongoing, and they're getting there. Revenues were up 5% for the full year. Operating profit up 1%, pre-tax up 1%, dividend nudged up slightly. So none of it's desperately thrilling in the short term. But fleet, you know, revenues were up 14%, insurance revenues were down 12%. So you can see how that switch is working out. In the bits that they wanted to do, fleet subscriptions were up 20%, customers were up 20%, insurance customers, I think, were down 17%. So again, you can see how the mix is shifting where they want it to go. It's taking time. They're pulling in all these new subscribers on the fleet side, which means that obviously fleet owners can track drivers, what they're doing, how fast they're going, what their accident levels are, what's going on, and therefore hopefully manage their insurance bills and make the fleet more efficient. Good recurring revenue based from subscriptions. And there's a net cash balance sheet. So in that respect, it's all perfectly solid. The strategy's working. Again, it's just one of those where there's quite a bit baked into the valuation already. It's on 28 times forward earnings, but there's a 3.5% yield, a net cash balance sheet. You can afford to wait. I guess the one thing that's clearly going to be potential fly in the ointment for all highly rated stocks, and that is that if interest rates and bond yields keep going up, then that increases the discount rate and your discounted cash flow model, and that decreases the net present value of your future cash flow. So it could impact the valuation. So these long duration assets where profits are very back end loaded, mm-hmm, aren't always a brilliant thing to own at a time if bond yields really start galloping higher for all of their long-term growth potential. So you've got to be a little bit careful there. But this is one where the strategic shift is in process. Great potential long-term. You're either going to be a long-term growth hunter and stick with it, or you're just going to be a value player and look at the valuation and go, not for me, move away, thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, since 2007, the start of this
the chart, it's flat as a pancake, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. Well, it started off the year a bit volatile, went down to sort of 280, then went up to sort of 4 quid. But since, that's 2017, sorry. Yeah, since mid-2017, just been trading between 340 and 380. It's all been trading within that range, yeah. So, we'll see what happens there. Do a breakout either to the upside or downside. Who knows?
Yes.
What's the last one, Russ?
So we've done QTX on AIM. We're now going to do QXT on AIM, which is Quixent. QXT, 250 million market cap. And remember, this is the thing that makes the brains behind what we would call fruit machines, we're now called fixed odds betting terminals or gaming machines or what have you. January trading update was fine. We've got the full year figures coming up on the 22nd of March. I think where they've already flagged sales up 20%, pre-tax profit in line at $11.5 million, $4 million of cash. Just the thing that caught my eye this week was a management shuffle. CEO's gone to become vice chairman, COO has become CEO, and the CFO wants to retire. And the new CFO, who's coming in October, is Guy Millward, who's ex-Imagination and ex-QL, and he's got a terrific CV. So I think that's, you know, you'd probably view that as certainly no bad thing by any means. Now it's all eyes down on the full year figures, where we've got good, you know, we've got analysts penciling in 18% growth, and these are the numbers to watch for going forwards. The consensus for 18% growth earnings per share wise in 2018 and 2019. Companies trading on a PE in the mid-20s for 2018, so you really need them to be generating that type of figure. But it's breaking into some of the bigger accounts. It's a relatively consolidated market. Still seems to be plenty of volume growth out there, and it's a high-techy, high-growthy. But again, as we know, it needs to generate that upside surprise in the short term to get the share price going. But at the moment, for growthies, it's probably one of the ones that will still be very much on their radar.
Yeah, I'm just reading here. It's almost like one of those little plastic games you have. You have to slot the little bits, little square blocks into the gap, you know, and make a big picture. Because the CEO got a vice chairman, CFO is retired, and Guy Millward in the CFO. So, it's chopping and changing around there. Marvellous stuff, Russ. Thanks for that, and we'll speak next week.
No trouble at all. Yeah, I look forward to it. Thanks, Justin. Appreciate your time. Take care now.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Connor Campbell, market analyst with Spreadex. You all right, fella?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. And just to explain, Connor comes on and he highlights some of the bigger companies releasing news in the week or next week. And Connor, what are we looking at? What's the first one up, fella?
On Tuesday, first up, we've got Fevertree Drinks, sort of an AIM sort of super stock, really. Yeah. It had a fantastic 2017. I think it was up 98% over 2017. And even that was off of the highs it hit during the year, which is sort of astonishing. Since then, sort of kept climbing. I think at the moment it's trading at around £27, maybe a bit above, which is an all-time high for the stock. It's, you know, it's a real biggie, a real favourite of people. Or at least it was a real favourite of people looking for some rapid growth, which is obviously certainly delivered. Earlier in the year, you had a bit of takeover speculation with the stock. The stock was sort of denied that, and it hasn't really come to anything. But I think it did plant that seed in investors' minds that, you know, one day it's the kind of stock that might be a target of someone like Unilever or a similar sized company that are looking to you know, buy up what for all this, you know, it's £27. It does still only do, like, you know, tonics and mixers, which is sort of remarkable, really. How much it's grown in what is a fairly niche product, or not niche, but a very specific product.
It's a $3 billion market cap, you know, so it's a big company considering what it does. Yeah, excellent. What do you reckon? What's happening here?
Yeah, I think in January it said it's expecting its annual revenue to come in 66% higher year on year at £169 million. I think that was after sales had risen 58% in the second half of the year. In terms of breaking that down by region, I think the UK is expected to see a 96% rise. That's obviously where the bulk of its base is. In the US, I think revenue is expected to jump 39%, which is very strong. In continental Europe, 42%. The rest of the world, 57%. So really strong growth across the board there. In terms of full-year profits, I think it also said that it'd be comfortably ahead of market expectations. I think that's the 12th time it's revised its full-year profit forecast higher since it debuted in 2014. It's like consistently outperformed sort of every opportunity. Obviously, that does. I think even the company itself have said it does leave it in that kind of precarious position where investors' expectations are constantly being ramped up. That I imagine if it were to underperform expectations, the pullback would be quite dramatic. However, at the moment, our clients, despite it being at all-time highs, our clients are still pretty behind the stock. They're still buying at £27 mark. I will say that, you know, at those levels, sellers have begun to appear, but predominantly our clients are buying still at the £27 mark, despite sort of, I guess, the risk attached with a stock that has climbed so sharply in the last, I guess, like 14 months.
Yeah, well, do you know what? It's just, I can't believe it's valued where it is. Like I said, for those kind of metrics,
it's crazy.
For revenue of what, 169 million, they said. Is that right? Yeah, 169 million for the full year.
169 million for the year.
And yet they're valued at 3.1 billion. What's going on here? That is crazy valuation, isn't it? It's absolutely nuts. And someone's got them, I try to look at their PE value, but obviously it differs on different sites, but some have got them way above 100. You know, price earnings ratio, which is madness when you consider, you know, a sort of I suppose high P's about 20, over 20. You know, people consider over 20, and maybe low is below 10. They're on 100, so or above. So it is nuts. You're prying it's a hefty price for that. And it's odd, isn't it? Sometimes stocks get this kind of high valuation. They're seen as a golden stock, and
I think it's just in tonics. Each time it reports, it's got those really eye-catching figures and things like that. But it's for, you know, ASOS at least makes sense because it's clothes. But this is just tonics, and, you know, it's not a particularly wide range. Obviously, it might do something a bit beyond tonics, but it is still essentially mixers for things like gin. And however big gin is as a drink, it's still,
I think this is a good chance to short this. I really think, because I mean, I wouldn't obviously tell, it's not investment advice to anyone, but I'm just saying that you know, when you get growth companies like this, and like the trading update is out there already, it's rallied on that. What further news they're going to release is going to take this through the sky. So I just think it's just due a pullback, surely. But then you can get burned, obviously. But I mean, I think it's due a pullback here. But so there we go. Okay, Fevertree FEVR. Anything else, Connor?
Yeah, then you've got Morrisons on Wednesday, one of the bigger companies reporting. It's four-year figures on Wednesday. It's had sort of a bit of a disappointing end to 2017. I think it ended up across the year being down 5%, and it fell fairly sharply from sort of mid-September onwards, which was odd because mid-September was when it released its half-year figures. They were very strong. I think it saw a 40% rise in reported pre-tax profit. Like-for-like sales were up 3%. You know, by and large, the data coming out of Morrisons is very strong. I think in November, first quarter like-for-like sales were up 2.5%. Now, I was down on the 2.8%, and this had been expecting, and the 3%, like I said, just mentioned for the half year, but there's still a healthy rise for what is a very difficult sector at the moment. But along those lines, he did say that it sort of worked hard during the first quarter not to pass on, you know, the impact of inflationary pressures to customers, because I guess whilst that's a sector-wide issue, out of the big four supermarkets, Morrisons is most at risk from having its customers, I guess, go to Aldi and Lidl. You know, it's seen as the sort of, out of those big four supermarkets, it's like the bargain supermarket. It's the cheaper one out of Tesco, Sainsbury's, Asda and Morrisons. So that it stands to lose the most ground to Aldi and Lidl if it doesn't keep those prices, like, which is, I guess, something to watch out for heading into the full-year figures on Wednesday. In terms of January, like-for-like sales, again, I think it was for the 10 weeks of the 7th of January, they were up 2.8%. I think its premium range, its best premium range, had seen sales increase 25%, which is good. It shows that people that are going to Morrisons are willing to splash out, I guess, for its premium range, so it can maybe slightly change the perception around what kind of price range is to be expected at a Morrisons store. I think online sales are also up 10%, which is good. Obviously, it's got the tie up with Amazon as well there, which is always helpful. In terms of its full year figures on Wednesday, I think investors are going to want to have seen that 2.8% growth for the 10 weeks to 7th of January continue across the fourth quarter as a whole. I think if it does come in at around 2.8%, I think that does leave its full year like-for-like sales on track for around a 2.8% increase, which again, like I said, is very healthy. And I think given the sector it's in, that kind of growth isn't anything to be sniffed at, if you especially look at the kind of struggles that have been seen at supermarkets elsewhere, really. In terms of, I think also the main driver is likely going to be what kind of impact has the inflationary pressures and rising input cost prices and things like that had on its margins and had on its earnings. I think that's really going to dictate the reaction on Wednesday. Ditto what kind of guidance it gives for its financial 2018 and where it sees growth in the rest of the year. In terms of our clients, they're buying at the 225 market. It's sort of it's been ranging between 210 and 230 since the start of the year, and I think they're looking for it to break a bit beyond 230, hopefully, after the full year figures on Wednesday.
Yeah. What's nuts is that, I'm looking at Morrisons compared to Fevertree, right? So their interim results, now, their interest is 6 months, obviously, 6 months worth of, or 26 weeks, yeah, six months. So their revenue for 6 months was 8.4 billion, right? Now, their market cap is 5 billion, 500, and yet Fevertree, market cap over 3 billion, they're expected to do 169 million in a year. This company here, I mean, you know, ridiculous. I mean, gross profit of Morrisons for 6 months. The operator has got a profit before tax. So 200 million they made in 6 months. That's the profit of Morrisons. Yeah. Yeah. Now, that's in 6 months. So they've made more profit before tax than Fevertree revenue will be the entire year. And yet, you know, Fevertree are 3 billion, valuation 3.2, and Morrisons are 5 billion. Just doesn't make any sense, doesn't it? And that's why I understand people who are investing, you know, or new to investing, don't understand, and they go on P's and stuff. Yeah. P's a lot of times don't make a lot of sense. That's why momentum often is the thing to look at. And, you know, when a stock is hot, then people don't. There's no momentum indicator. You know, when people are looking at stocks and traditional values, like earnings per share or PE value and all that, there's no sort of indicator for momentum, really. And so that's why, you know, if you go on traditional metrics, you miss out on big movers because you're looking at, that makes sense. But there we go. I mean, well, if you stand in the way of momentum, you can't, like I said, if you try to take out a short or something like Fevertree, you can get burned because momentum is a very powerful thing. And once it's got it, you know, it doesn't tend to lose it. Anyway, interesting. Anything else, Colin, we're looking at?
Yeah, finally on Friday, we've got Wetherspoons, which I was very surprised. I hadn't really been keeping up with the Wetherspoons. I looked at its chart for 2017. I think it was up 41% over 2017, which is very strong for a
what's the ticker? JDW, isn't it? JDW, yeah.
Yeah, for a stock that, you know, again, is facing like input cost pressures and things like that. I think a large chunk of its 2017 growth came in mid-September following its full-year figures. I think it revealed a 27.6% rise in annual pre-tax profit to 102.8 million, which is, you know, nothing to be sniffed at. And ditto 4% rise in like-for-like sales. Again, very strong. That sort of continued really into its last couple of updates. In January, I think it said that its interim like-for-like sales were up 6%, with total sales up 4.3%, which is again very strong. And I think I can't remember when it was, but for the sector as a whole, I think like for the pub sector, like-for-like sales were on average rising 1%. So the fact that Wetherspoons is posting 6% is remarkable, really. It also said the underlying pre-tax profit for the half year, which is going to be released on Friday, would be slightly ahead of expectations. I think the full year forecasts stand at around £101.2 million. So anything around the mid-mark of that, I think, will be good. However, I guess the key issue with Wetherspoons is it did say back in January that the performance it saw in the first half of the year will be more difficult to achieve in the second half of the year. So I think the main driver of movement on Friday is likely more going to be what kind of guidance it gives for the second half of the year and what kind of, you know, current trading update it provides, more so than the first half figures, really. Because, you know, it was at all-time highs. It pulled back, and then now it's sort of approaching them again. It's getting back towards £13. So there is the danger there of if it does say, "Oh, we're only going to manage, you know, X amount of like-for-like growth," and it's significantly lower than the 6% it managed for the first half of the year, that investors might start to abandon it. From our clients' perspective, they're still buying around the £13 mark, just because those like-for-like figures, I guess, have been so strong of late. but it is, I think, going to be dictated by what kind of outlook it gives for the second half of the year.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just look at. I just want to see. Right, it is nuts, isn't it? I look at JD Weatherspoon. Right, 1.3 billion is their market cap, is their valuation, and you know their revenue for the last full year, for the end of 30th of July, was 1.6 billion. So that's 10 times Fevertree's, and yet they're valued at half the rate. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So yeah, and we're very aware, you know, of JD Weatherspoon's presence and in Morrison's presence up and down the country. But what do we know of Fevertree really?
Not yeah, enough, I imagine if you ask, if you surveyed like 100 people on the street, you know, half of them maybe would have heard of Fevertree, whereas what, near enough 100% are going to have heard of Weatherspoons and Morrison's. Like you said, like their daily presence is in people's lives, whereas Fevertree is, it's still, it's quite a niche thing.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Especially if you can buy Butler Tonic for like 50p in a supermarket, you know, a supermarket own brand Butler Tonic for 50p instead of a couple of quid for a Fevertree bottle, and it's significantly bigger.
Right? Well, I suppose that's the point. I mean, you know, Morrison's and JD Weatherspoon's, I mean, they do have a lot of capital. They're tied up in these stores and there's stock and all that stuff, and their margins are very slim. Whereas I imagine Fevertree margins are massive because they're essentially just liquid. They charge it's like making perfume, isn't it? It's liquid with a couple of smells put into it, and they charge like 50 quid.
I know, exactly.
Yeah. They probably cost them 5p to make, if that. So, the margin's huge, but that still doesn't stack up when you're only achieving, you know, 169 millions worth of revenue and your valuation is 3 billion. Doesn't stack up at all. Anyway, that's it. Connor, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak next week.
Yeah, talk next week.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are as follows. At five, Clear Leisure. At CLP. At four, Seeing Machines. S-E-E. C. At three, Horizonte Minerals, HZM. At two, Ascent Resources, AST. And number one is Conviviality. I know Alan Green has mentioned them a couple of times. They own this sort of company that owns Free Booze. No, is it Free Booze? Not Free Booze, is it? It's Cheap Booze. Cheap Booze, that's it. The shops you see there. Cheap Booze. They're booze, it's cheap. CVR is the ticker there. Okay. Top five most liked RNSs came from the following companies. Main Energy at five, update on heavy oil sands project in Utah Saints. At four, Harvest Minerals at shareholder conference call. At three, Seeing Machines. See? Statement regarding press speculation. Ooh. At two, Vast Resources, update on proposed $9.5 million prepayment offtake with Mercuria Energy Group. And number one, most liked RNS, came from SDX Energy, and that's gas discovery at SAR or SAR 2 well in Morocco. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz, discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.